The next topic discussed in the think tank was management of patients with primary colon cancer and simultaneous metastatic disease. Recently, the NSABP launched NSABP-C10, a small phase 2 trial in which asymptomatic patients will receive therapy with FOLFOX bevacizumab, and 60% of the think tank audience agreed with this statement. For asymptomatic patients presenting with primary colon cancer and metastatic disease, the management strategy of choice is enrollment in NSABP trial C10 evaluating FOLFOX bevacizumab. To begin his interview, Dr. Wallmark commented on this issue.
As surgeons, we have all been taught that the right thing to do in situations where patients present with a simultaneous primary colonic tumor and metastatic disease is resect the primary lesion. And the reasons that we have been given, and when I say we have been given, I'm not being entirely accurate because I have actively participated and have taught this as well to medical students and residents, that if you leave the primary tumor, then you're going to end up with inordinate rates of obstruction, of perforation, of bleeding, and you're going to pay a greater price later than you would by doing the operation sooner. And of course, this was a carryover from an era where chemotherapy or therapy for metastatic disease really didn't have the same kinds of benefits that it does today. So what is the magnitude of this situation? Is it really an issue, or are we creating something? But if you look at the SEER data, for example, there are approximately 27,000 patients who present with this kind of situation a year with a simultaneous primary and concomitant metastatic lesions. It's not a small number. And only 20% have significant symptoms.
Do we know how these people are getting diagnosed? You know, if they don't have symptoms, I assume that in some way they've been screened and diagnosed.
This, right, and during the workup of the primary lesion, it's determined that they already have metastatic disease. Or they come in when somebody does a screening and finds that they're anemic.
But we don't know that much about the demographics of these patients.
I certainly don't.
So maybe we'll learn more, too, with this study.
I hope that this study for a 90-patient trial, I think, has enormous potential for disclosing a great deal of information that we don't know. And, you know, that's why we have a lot of enthusiasm for it. So it's estimated that out of those 27,000, that approximately 70% are treated with primary resection. And it's that the level of enthusiasm for primary resection is more common in younger patients, right-sided lesions. But it comes at a price, because the operative mortality in patients who have metastatic disease is higher. And it goes up with the age of the patient. And, you know, although these are small studies, it certainly challenges our basic beliefs. It's estimated that as age goes up, the operative mortality could be as high as 10%, which is pretty significant. And it's also estimated, again, with small series, that approximately a quarter of these patients end up by having a colostomy or another ostomy. So relative to quality of life, these are very important issues.
The other issue is you've got metastatic disease and you're not giving them systemic therapy while they get operated on and recover from surgery.
Yeah, that too is something that we would like to address with this study. It's going to be addressing it indirectly because it's a 90-patient trial that's focused very specifically to specific endpoints. But those kinds of issues are exactly what is relevant in today's setting. You do the operation per primum, delay therapy, whether we can do better by giving it up front. I mean, this is really, you know, the preoperative setting. Another tertiary endpoint of this trial is how many patients can we convert from inoperable to operable.
In terms of the metastatic disease.
In terms of the metastatic disease and primary. So these patients, based on the eligibility criteria, are deemed inoperable by the participating surgeon. So what proportion of these individuals can we make operable with a modern regimen such as FOLFOX6 with bevacizumab?
What do we know about response rates in primary lesions to systemic therapy?
We don't know a whole lot. In the rectum, there are not a lot of data. I mean, we have
some neoadjuvant chemo radiation, certainly in rectal.
In rectal.
But I mean, in colon, are there any data?
No, I don't believe there are, because nobody treats colon cancers in the preoperative setting. We operate on those patients. Very often they come into the system only after the surgeon has resected the lesion.
It's kind of interesting to contemplate. I mean, certainly individual physicians, particularly those who specialize in colorectal cancer, have utilized this strategy. I ask them a lot, well, what happens? But you're saying there's no formalized database.
I don't believe so. I mean, not for colon lesions. So, I mean, first there's the fear, are we going to have bleeding and so on? And of course, this is another endpoint that this protocol is going to address.
What are the specific endpoints and what's the eligibility?
Well, the eligibility consists of a patient who presents with a primary lesion, untreated, with concomitant metastatic disease, considered by the investigator to be not resectable. It has to be colon primary,
locally not resectable.
Rectal lesions.
You're saying
for the metastatic lesion.
Oh, the metastatic.
So if you had a patient who presented with a concomitant primary colonic tumor and liver metastasis that are amenable to hepatic resection or hepatic resection and ablation to render that patient, quote, disease-free, that would not be an eligible patient.
That's interesting, because, I mean, you could imagine those people would be interesting to look at for this strategy, too.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you know, we don't want to alter what some people would consider the standard of care. And certainly we know that we have pretty impressive survival rates with those individuals who have liver-only disease that one can resect.
So they can't be surgically curable as they're presenting.
Precisely.
With the metastatic disease. What other eligibility? Is that it?
That's basically it. I mean, there's some other subtle ones that are related to the treatment. We don't want patients whose risk would be increased with the use of bevacizumab. So similar criteria as were used for CO8 or applied here. We don't want somebody with, you know, active ulcer disease and so on and so forth.
Recent arterial events.
Recent arterial events within 6 months, recent MIs within 6 months.
So does the protocol specify about the symptom status of the patient? Do they have to be
asymptomatic.
Totally, of everything, or just of the local tumor?
They have to be asymptomatic. I mean, that is stipulated in the protocol.
And so what is the treatment regimen and what's actually going to be looked at in this study?
Okay. So the treatment regimen consists of FOLFOX6 with bevacizumab, as it was in NSABP protocol CO8. And the endpoints of the study consist of operations for complications of the primary tumor. So if there's an operation for bleeding, perforation, fistula, obstruction, or death related to the primary tumor, not to metastasis, that is an event.
But the specific management of the patient, other than the fact that they get the FOLFOX Bev, is kind of left up to the doc?
Precisely.
So they can decide, okay, well, now I'm going to operate on the primary or not operate or whatever.
Well, no, down the line, if there's progression or if there's obstruction or if there's perforation, then they have to operate as they would do for the safety of the patient.
Right. And you look at this as a phase two study. What other endpoints are you looking at?
Those are the primary endpoints.
What about clinical response?
What are the criteria? Well, no, clinical responses are not
really
a major endpoint of the trial.
So you're not looking at whether the Mets shrink or anything like that?
No, the trial is powered specifically to determine what the outcome is relative to the primary tumor.
Interesting.
And what we have defined is that if we have less than a 25% incidence of events related to the primary tumor, this protocol will be considered a success, or this therapeutic intervention will be considered a success. If it's over that, it will be considered unsuccessful. So we want to safeguard the patients. It's a 90-patient trial, and we're looking for under 25% events. Events related to the primary tumor as defined by an operation for the primary tumor as a result of bleeding, perforation, fistula, and obstruction, or death from the primary tumor. So we want to safeguard. We don't want to just take 90 patients and then at the end you find out that you've had catastrophes in 80. So we're using the Simon two-step really the sign two stage. It's really not a little dance, since we don't want to apply that approach to patient well-being.
What's the Simon 2 step?
Well, we're going to enter 30 patients to have 26 evaluable. Hmm. And then the trial goes into hiatus. Hmm. So we can determine what the event rate, what the proportion of those first 30 or 26 patients have undergone an operation for bleeding, perforation, fistula, and obstruction. And, you know, if the proportion is greater than 10 out of those first 30, then we're going to stop the trial. Hmm. If it's under 10, we're going to continue and enter the next 60 patients. So we're really doing everything possible to safeguard the well-being of these patients, and we have to have predefined criteria for success or failure.
How have surgeons responded to this? Are they supportive, or some people like not comfortable with it?
No, I think they're very supportive. I think everybody thinks that it's really a trial that should be done. I mean, for a 90-patient trial, I mean, the opportunity of answering a great many clinically relevant questions, I think, is outstanding. So I think, by and large, we've gotten support. This trial has to wend its way through the IRBs.
Right.
I think, you know, some institutions from a practical standpoint are reluctant in participating in 90-patient trials because by the time you get it through, you know, the process, the danger is that accrual is completed.
You know, it's interesting when you think about 27,000 people, that's more than a lot of diseases that we have whole trials about. Do you see this sort of evolving into a whole subset that's going to have a series of trials around it?
It would all depend on the data that we see and the additional endpoints that aren't even specified. I mean, what proportion can we convert to being operable?
That would be the interesting question.
For example,
right.
A case in point. I mean, you know, how well do they do? How long do they live? Is the primary tumor going to be a problem? The belief that giving bevacizumab to an intact primary tumor is something that one ought never do is something that we're going to address with this protocol.
And I guess the other issue is going to be if people do need emergent surgery, how's that going to sit with Bev on board?
Well, precisely. I mean, these are all, if you're faced with the prospect of an emergency operation, you don't have the luxury to stop the bevacizumab for 2 weeks.
So is there any reason to think that biologically these tumors might be different than other colon cancers?
No.
Do you think it's just a question of when they're diagnosed?
I don't think so at all. No. Do we think that the responsiveness of the primary lesion is going to be different than the lesions that we've been accustomed to treating up to now? I don't believe so. I mean, we've already crossed that point in that we've used it in advanced disease. It's approved in advanced disease. We just completed a very large trial, CO8, in the adjuvant setting, where we've obviously brought it to a much earlier phase. So we didn't hesitate in doing that study. So this, to us, makes perfect sense as a trial that will move the state of the art forward, or at least is positioned to do so. For a 90-patient trial, it has a lot of opportunity for answering questions. I think the one thing it does underscore is that not everything needs a randomized, prospective phase 3 trial with 2,700 patients. Here you have a specific situation of which very little is known. And this 90-patient trial, I think, is well-positioned to really enhance our understanding of this situation.
I think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic that this is going to go well, too. I mean, who knows? Yeah, there might be problems, but...
We're obviously very optimistic. Otherwise, we wouldn't have started the trial.
I'm trying to think about other situations and other cancers in terms of what we know about response of primaries to systemic therapy. I mean, we see some patients like that in breast cancer, and I guess the responses are at least as good in metastatic disease.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we crossed that bridge in breast.
Sure.
I mean, whenever we talk about colon cancer, I mean, the breast model is years ahead.
Right.
And there, I think that when we have concomitant disease, it's not a great debate as to leaving the primary intact and going ahead with chemotherapy and then operating as needed.
Yeah, it's a palliative model.
In colon, it raises a debate. It's like the stage 2, stage 3 phenomenon and so many other issues that show a disconnect between breast and colon.
Although, you know, it's a little bit scary to think about a primary in your belly where, you know, maybe something's going to happen unexpected as opposed to in the breast where maybe not quite as much as possible. Well,
that's true, but I think that the preliminary data that justified C10 is the fact that operating is not a trivial event. It's associated with mortality. It's associated with postoperative complications. As a matter of fact, there's one study that suggests that the incidence of obstruction is the same whether you operate or don't operate.
Wow, interesting.
Obstruction due to peritoneal disease with extrinsic compression. So do we really help that patient by operating per primum?
It'd be interesting to follow these people for 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, presumably they're going to die.
That would be great if we have the luxury right. to do that if they're around that long.
Well, I mean, for whatever time they are around, I guess my point would be, and to see, I assume since your endpoints are kind of, you know, immediate, that you're not going to look at this. But it'd be interesting to see sort of from a quality of life point of view, even if the patients do succumb to their disease, whether having, you know, maybe some of them can permanently avoid ever having surgery. And
presume that the majority will not require an operation down the line.
So, you know, if you look at somebody who perhaps, let's say, dies after a year and a half or 2 years, and they've been able to avoid the pain and discomfort and recovery period of a major surgical operation from a palliative point of view, that's pretty
precisely
positive.
If the tumor remains stable and they die of metastatic disease, or the tumor is not the end. Certainly the bulk of disease is larger outside the colon than it is inside the colon.
But also, I could envision a scenario where maybe the primary does end up becoming a problem, and I guess that's the point of this study.
Exactly.
The Think Tank faculty addressed the issue of management of patients with colon cancer and simultaneous metastatic disease, beginning with Dr. Goldberg.
Norma, is the NSABP, which I believe stands for National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Program, going to become the NSNAMBP for the National Surgical and Non-Surgical Adjuvant and Metastatic Breast and Bowel Program?
Richard, we have always been a group of surgeons that has endeavored to eliminate the role of surgery. We've done it in breast, where we've been far more successful at doing it in colon, which may bespeak to the fact that those individuals involved with colon surgery and colon treatment are perhaps a little bit more stultified than those who treat breast cancer.
Agree, disagree, or in between, the NSABP should get involved with adjuvant lung cancer trials. I've been trying to get
them. No, sir.
Don't even start with that. Okay. I'd like to find out what the faculty is actually doing in their practice off study, and have they had patients they've treated, and what's happened? Axel?
First of all, the BRIGHT data have been alluded to. The BRIGHT trial registry, about 2,000 patients followed prospectively, all on bevacizumab and plus any chemotherapy that in participants wanted and received. About 16% of patients had the primary intact, so that's a substantial number. And there were 3.4% gastrointestinal perforations, which is about twice as high as in the normal population, but of course, eliminating the risk of primary surgery. So there is kind of a trade-off balance. And it's not the majority of patients that will have a perforation. It's a fraction of patients that will have a perforation. So you could set the bar lower, but these are clinical trial design issues, not necessarily relevant for our clinical practice. I think the message that I would give right now, if we think that the metastasis of a patient are the dominating life-threatening situation, I start with chemotherapy with intact primary right away, and I use bevacizumab in my clinical practice.
Dan, you know, in an asymptomatic patient, and the analogy might be breast cancer, we leave the primary intact and use it as an indicator lesion and wait and see if there's a local problem. Does that strategy make sense in this situation?
I think it does, and I think it has to be highly individualized. So it's the intersection between the patient, me, and the surgeon who sees the patient to make the final decision. So a non-obstructing, non-bleeding lesion, more often than not, we leave in place. But what I do is I stick on the front of the chart, just like as an allergy, remember the primary is still there. Because I had a patient that I treated for about 2.5 years with metastatic disease, and she said, do I need a colonoscopy? And of course, we never had people live long enough to need another colonoscopy. She said, what's my primary doing? Well, when it's been observed, the primaries are usually more sensitive in terms of response than the metastatic disease. So if you're getting control of the metastatic disease independent of the bev issue, I worry less about an obstruction appearing out of nowhere. But
and
again,
you have to have an educated patient. You can see the monitor. Primaries on CT scan nowadays.
Yeah, frequently you can.
and follow them.
Yeah.
Have you treated patients like that, Rich? And what have you seen with the primaries?
Yes, my default is not to operate on people who present with widely metastatic disease unless they're obstructed or bleeding. And I have been willing to give them bevacizumab, Dr. Wallmark.
And any observation in terms of the response you see in the primary compared to what you typically see with metastatic disease, Rich?
The primaries seem to be quite responsive, and it's been interesting to follow them.
Again, I think that's precisely why this trial will provide us with useful information.
Actually, I think this point that primary can respond is important because some surgeons don't believe that. I mean, normally you're an exception of the rule, but I routinely hear at Mayo Clinic primaries don't respond. We need to do surgery, and this is not true.
Right.
For the individual in the audience who remarked that I needed a colonoscopy, you're absolutely right. Thank you. It's been 5 years.
Howard? That's been our experience also, and in fact, a couple patients who've undergone colonoscopy have had unobservable primaries at that point. So I think the primary is more sensitive than the liver metastases often. And in fact, in terms of bleeding, I have yet to see anybody who, even when they presented with anemia, so they have chronic iron deficiency blood loss, that they actually have a major bleeding problem. So I have not had that be a problem either. I guess one thing that interested me, there were a couple questions about stents, endocolonic stents, to relieve partial obstructions or near obstructions, and can you treat people safely with that? And I've done it once and didn't have a perforation, but wondering if anybody else has had that experience and if there is a higher risk of perforation with a stent in place.
Neil, what about the issue of rectal cancer and simultaneous metastatic disease and how you might integrate radiation into all that?
Yeah, again, I side with the other members of the panel that I tend to defer surgery in general, and I'm comfortable using bevacizumab as long as there isn't a lot of bleeding or significant bleeding. In the case of rectal cancer, this again becomes an individualization of therapy issue, and I've done it a number of different ways, and now we're talking about a patient who has potentially resectable metastatic disease. I've given chemotherapy first. I've done chemotherapy and radiation up front when there wasn't bulky metastatic disease. I've had people go and have their primary resected to enable the delivery earlier on of full systemic therapy with the comfort that there was reasonable local control, and reserved radiation adjuvant therapy till the end. So I've done it a number of different ways, and again, this is what keeps Rich interested in his practice, because there's a lot of nuance here, and everybody's different.
Neil, another question, which is cetuximab. You don't have the issue about wound healing. What about that in this situation?
Sure. So there are certainly data, phase two data, with regard to the addition of cetuximab to FOLFOX chemotherapy, which in a reasonably sized phase two study, there seemed to be a very high response rate. That said, this is not an enormous experience, and other frontline data have been presented by Allen with regard to chemotherapy plus cetuximab showing improved response with the addition of cetuximab. So I do believe it's an option in patients who haven't been previously treated. We don't have big experience with long-term data, but it certainly is likely to improve response rate, I think, when added to chemotherapy.
Norm, what went into the decision to choose Bev for the study?
Well, we thought it was, in this setting, the right option, and that, you know, one of the hopes of this trial is really to determine what the complications are as a result of using the bevacizumab.
I just want to make one other point. I mean, I think the cetuximab questions are reasonable, but we still have to bear in mind that there's no survival data for first-line cetuximab yet, and we do have that for bevacizumab, so the data sets are not equivalent at this point in time.